Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Turn your tax refund into a new kitchen with Menards. Make this the year you check that project off the list. Renovate your space with new cabinets from Cardell. They're ready to install and come in a variety of styles and finishes with free shipping to your home. Visit our kitchen showrooms in-store or go to Menards.com for free estimates today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer for all of our hot deals going on now.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello everyone and welcome to the History Hotline, the hottest line for all things Black history and beyond.
Hello everyone and welcome to episode 75 of the History Hotline. My name is Deanna Lincook and as always I'm your host today, and today's episode is unfortunately going to be quite an upsetting one, I will say. It's about a man called David Oluwale. Before I get into the episode, I'll start with a trigger warning and just to say that there's a lot of violence in this episode and it's just a really sad story. And I'll be honest, I never wanted to make this podcast. And, you know, once you've listened, you can kind of take that as you will. But I really didn't ever want to make an episode about what happened to David Oluwale because it's just, one of the most horrific stories, I think, in like 20th century Black British history. And it's not even Black British history, it's British history. And it's just a terrible story. There's really no other way. There's no silver lining here. There's no like lesson learned. There's no cloud. Like, it's not a nice story. You know, if you're having a nice day and you don't want to be put in the headspace of a horrific story, then this episode might not be for you. And I will say that. And, you know, don't ever feel, you know, sad or, you know, like you've let me down if you don't listen to an episode that's going to be traumatic, because sometimes you have to choose joy. And if that's for you today, then please feel free to listen to something else. But in light of recent events in regards to David Oluwale, it is important for me to tell this story today. Let's get into it. So David Oluwale was a Nigerian man. He was born in Lagos in 1930 and he migrated from Nigeria to Britain in August 1949. Now, he was officially classified as a stowaway because he was hiding on board a cargo ship that was on its way to Hull, as he couldn't afford the fare and wanted to move to Britain. Now, obviously, at that time in 1949, Nigeria is a British colony, and he was able to get something called a British travel certificate. He would have been a British citizen. And so left Nigeria, Lagos, Nigeria, to come to Britain. He came aboard a ship called the Temple Bar ship, and he was hiding amongst boxes of groundnuts that were being delivered to Hull. He was discovered a few days into his journey, and so when the ship arrived, he was jailed. Now, this stowaways, it sounds like something in like a, what's that film called? The one with the pirates. Pirates of the Caribbean, like a stowaway on a pirate ship. That's what's conjuring in my mind anyway. But, you know, he was a stowaway and that was illegal. So he was arrested when he arrived and he was put in prison. Sometimes, and I do remember some cases, especially in the Caribbean, on the Windrush kind of era ships that, yeah, came from the Caribbean to Britain, stowaways would often just get sent, like, straight back. Like, they'd just go on the return voyage. also, obviously, the other option was to be arrested and imprisoned. And, you know, once you serve your sentence, you would be free. He is, at the end of the day, a British citizen. And, you know, he was released a little while later. And he spent a lot of his life, or pretty much all of it, in Leeds. It's where he kind of naturally found himself, where he moved to and, you know, started to kind of set up a life for himself. And, you know, it's been said that he was really fond of the, like, American-style suit, so that his nickname was Yankee. And, you know, there's very few facts about him. We know very little about his life, but we know a lot about the way he died and his last months on Earth. And this is where things get really dark. And, you know, he's not had the best start in life, being arrested as soon as he arrives in London at the age of about 19. But, you know, things just get unimaginably worse. And the circumstances he finds himself in, you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy, to be quite honest. On arrival in Britain, David Oluwole's kind of dreams were to be a tailor. He was a tailor by trade. But this, you know, wasn't something that was fulfilled, a dream that didn't happen, because in 1953, so about 4 years after his arrival, he became involved in an altercation with police and took a truncheon blow to his head. Now, you know, a truncheon is a very heavy object used to disarm someone, to stop them in their tracks, essentially, and to take that to the head is going to cause damage. And it did, because he was arrested and charged with disorderly conduct, and he was sent back to prison. And whilst in prison, he was reported to have been suffering from hallucinations. And obviously, you know, you put two and two together, he was hit on the head with a truncheon with force. So, you know, potentially suffered some kind of brain injuries at that point. He was labelled as a schizophrenic and sent to Menston, which was an asylum outside of Leeds. And that, you know, he didn't leave there for about 8 years. Whilst he was at Menston, and now, you know, you're thinking about 1960s here, I don't know what you know or what you don't know about mental health and the treatment of mental health in that time period. I don't know too much, but I know that it's definitely not what it is today. And the treatments that were used in a lot of cases would have made things worse rather than better. And Mr. Oluwole was treated with electric shock treatment, heavy antipsychotic tranquilizers, and, you know, if you've had a blow to the head with a truncheon, you know, you're labelled as a schizophrenic, whether that diagnosis was true or not, and then you're dealing with electric shock treatment and antipsychotic tranquilizers. To me, and as I said, I'm no expert, that just doesn't seem like it's going to work. It doesn't sound like it's going to help the person. It doesn't sound like it's going to have a positive impact. And, you know, you wouldn't be wrong to guess that it had a negative impact on his life. So, you know, he's already had a terrible start in his arrival in Britain. He isn't able to work as a tailor. And then this altercation with the police leaves him with a brain injury. You know, it might have been brain damage. We don't know that. I'm not a medical expert, but depending on the severity of that truncheon blow. Upon his release, which was about 8 years later, he struggled to secure and hold down a job, and quickly became homeless, which, you know, is not really something that is unexpected in a situation like this. The mental trauma, I'm sure, being a stowaway in the first place was not the best experience, going to prison and then going to Menston and dealing with what he dealt with there. It just wasn't really going to, you weren't going to see a positive outcome for David Oluwole at this point. And, you know, the story is quite short, because at this point, I say the words, he spent the last 2 years of his life, you know, and he ended up being homeless, as I said, sleeping rough in the city centre. And he didn't have a job. He didn't have family. He's come on his own as a stowaway. And because he was a stowaway as well, you've got to think there wouldn't have necessarily been great record keeping. He wouldn't have had, you know, a ticket purchase details or anything like that to trace back his family potentially or anyone he knew in Nigeria or in Lagos more specifically. And so in England, in Leeds, he's alone. He's homeless. He has mental health issues. He has severe traumas to the brain. And, you know, it's very understandable that he wouldn't necessarily have been able to help himself into a better situation at that point. And being so young when he arrived in Britain, you know, 19, it's not, you're not exactly, you're an adult in the eyes of the law, but you're not a fully formed, you know, adult brain, shall we say, if we say the brain. I think the brain finishes development at 25, so I've been told. Anyway, not the point. The final 2 years of his life, it feels like when I do a podcast on a person and I tell the story of their life, you know, at this point, normally we'd probably just be getting into like their adulthood, and what they did and what they achieved and what they wrote or what they did. And I'm thinking about the Darkest Hour episode where, you know, probably this amount of minutes in, if you go back and listen to Darkest Hour, we would just be getting into thinking about him being a journalist or into broadcasting. But we're already at the end of Mr. Olawale's life. And this is where I struggle, I'll be honest. This is where I struggle because I don't really know how people can be so cruel. But I do know, because we've got it right here in black and white. But essentially, he became the target of mental and physical abuse at the hands of two police officers, Inspector Jeffrey Ellicker and Sergeant Kenneth Kitching. And it's important we know their names because I think we should know sometimes what evil looks like and what evil is called on earth. And again, I give a trigger warning because what this man had to go through at the hands of these two men, policemen at that, you know, I don't have the best comments to make about police forces. But again, I always note that it's institutional and, you know, it's a system and all things like that. But in this case, and don't get me wrong, we're going to get into that system very soon. But this is, and yes, it's probably part of a culture of policing at that time, but this is just the evil, callous, vicious, disgusting, despicable behaviour of these two men, Ellicker and Kitching. They would beat him up. You know, this man is already mentally unwell with traumas, being in prison and a mental asylum place, electric shock therapy, a trunch into the head that could have caused all kinds of trauma or damage. They would beat him up. He would sleep in shop windows. They would urinate on him. At one point, they drove and dropped him 40 minutes away from like the Leeds city centre. Into the depths of a place called Middleton Woods, 40 minutes away by car. And he was just told to fend for himself and get back to wherever he was going, like in the middle of the night, you know, with the elements against him. He was a homeless man. They abused him, humiliated him, and yeah, routinely over like 18 months. This wasn't just, you know, one-off incident here and there. There was another story that the two police officers bundled him into a van and drove him to a country pub in the middle of the night and made him order a cup of tea and just laughed at him, humiliated him. And I just don't know how you'd even think of this stuff. Like, you're an officer of the law and you're urinating on a man that's homeless, sleeping in the streets, before you say to help him or, you know, give him a hand. Or just ignore him. Just leave him. He's not harming anyone in a doorway. But that was what David Olawale faced. And it was the 18th of April that it's believed to have been the day he died. And it was the last sighting of him alive. He was seen being chased by officers towards the River Aire. by those two officers, Ellico and Kitching. And 2 weeks later, his body was found in the water, face down. And obviously he was dead. So a year and a half of violence, humiliation, trauma, on top of everything else that man had gone through in his life. To then, and you know, we don't know for sure how he died. Although, I don't know about you, but I think two people that are capable of doing so much to a man that is so vulnerable and so helpless, I don't see why they wouldn't have pushed him in the river, chased him in the river, forced him to jump in some humiliation, whatever it was. This man lost his life that night. And then we think about, you know, what happened next. Because we know this man's name. We know his story now. Well, how did we get to this point? He died in 1969. And now this is where, whilst we think about the system of policing and the culture, I think it's important to recognise a good apple, shall we say. If we think about policing as a tree, a rotten tree, maybe some fruit survive. And that, in this case, it was a man called, a police cadet called Gavin Galvin. In 1970, he reported that he had heard, police people in the force gossiping about the way Ellica and Kitching had treated David Oluwale, and an inquiry was launched. And, you know, they tried to piece together what had happened based on the whistleblowing done by Gavin Galvin, who, I mean, you know, he could have heard that and just took it to his grave. He could have heard that and not said anything. But thankfully, he chose to say something. And because of that, that inquiry started. So the charges that were decided on for the two policemen were, in the end, manslaughter, perjury, and grievous bodily harm. Now, manslaughter, not murder, manslaughter. To me, if two people violently torment and humiliate somebody for nearly 2 years, and then they die in circumstances that involve them, and, you know, the witnesses saw them chasing David Oluwale with truncheons towards the river. I find it very difficult to understand why. Well, I don't find it difficult. It's called racism. But, you know, I find it difficult to understand why it wasn't murder, you know. I know that obviously the difference between murder and manslaughter is, you know, planning it and intent, but surely that was what would happen next after a year and a half to 2 years long campaign of violently beating, abusing, violating this man. Surely. Like, what else could that have been? But of course, the British justice system decided on manslaughter. They're police officers, after all. Do we expect anything else? Not really. And to be quite honest with you, manslaughter, you know, anything, like, charges against officers, this was the first time for the death of a black man that charges were brought to an officer, to two officers. And, you know, it's very, it's one of those things where you think, oh, yes, they got him. But I'm going to tell you the sentence and you're going to be like, eh, wow. It's beyond a slap in the face. So, they had all those charges against them, manslaughter, perjury, grievous bodily harm. You know, David Oluwale's body was found, taken out the river. They would have seen physically the violence, the abuse, the violation that took place on this man through, I'm sure, a catalogue of injuries. The trial was in November 1971, which is interesting because I'm thinking, just a little tangent, that's like mangrove times. Mangrove 9, and I'm thinking maybe because this was Leeds and not London, there's another element here whereby, one, we rarely look at histories outside of London. I'm guilty of that myself. And so stories like this go very much under the radar. And two, the way racism and violence towards black people functions in different cities, you know, there could be a point to make there as well. And so back to this sentencing, they were obviously had three charges against them. They were found guilty of only one of them, causing actual bodily harm. Elika received 36 months. Yes, you heard it right. 36 months, so 3 years. And Kitchen received 27 months, so just over 2 years. And I think that really, it just says it all. Actually, I'll be honest with you, we're not even at the bit that you can get really, really mad at. Like, if you're listening and, you know, you have feelings, you should already be quite furious, sad, upset, confused as to why maybe you didn't know this story before. I felt the same. But we're not even at the bit that really boils my blood. I'll be honest. So these two men have those pitiful sentences. And, you know, race is clearly a factor here. We've got issues here. We've got race, we've got class, we're thinking about homelessness, thinking about mental health, especially with black men. This is all the things that were happening in David Oluwole's life, the intersections of his identity. And, you know, all of these things taken into consideration. An interesting point that I read about was the fact that David Oluwole's nationality on his charge sheet was not listed as British or British Nigerian or Nigerian even. It was listed as WOG. Yep, the racial slur commonly used at that time, WOG. So the police officers on their charge sheet clearly showed elements of racial prejudice in literally writing his nationality as WOG. I've said that three times, yes, because I can't believe it either. And it's just, you know, the Race Relations Act is in full swing. And I've said it before, and I'm actually going to, next week's episode is actually going to be about this man, Michael X, who was the first person arrested under the Race Relations Act, or charged actually, or both. And he was black. Yeah, make that make sense. So, you know, you've got this act to protect black people, to protect people from racism. And it wasn't even thought of. And, you know, I'm sure there's complexities to the law that I do not understand that would make things like that harder to prosecute. But really, at this point, they got, what, not even 3 years, not even really, just over 5 years collectively, for what they did to that man. For what reason? You know, what did he do that was so terrible? You know, he was born with the wrong skin colour. Born with the wrong with the wrong setup in life, you know. Oh, anyway, the story goes on. Because, you know, as we have, let's say, developed the field of Black British history, and we've been diversifying the curriculum in different ways, David Oluwole's story comes to light. And, you know, it's not a nice story. You know, I wouldn't expect something like this to get taught in schools, I'll be honest with you, because this is a lot. This is a lot for me. And I've read this story several times, and I'm sure it's a lot for you too. But it is important to know this stuff at some point in your life. And the story gets worse, as I've said. Well, it gets worse. Because, you know, of all the things they did and the really short sentence, and then we move forwards and we think about the fact that, you know, we're now commemorating this man's life. He was buried in a grave with about 9 other people. The only person that attended his funeral was the vicar, because he didn't know anyone, and nobody seemed to care about his life. and especially not those police officers that took it. Whilst the prosecution of Ellacott and Kitching were, you know, the first time that British police officer had been, quote unquote, successfully tried for their involvement in the death of a black person, you know, this justice can only be characterised, and I take quote from a BBC article, as hollow. It was hollow justice. You know, how can you be... You can't celebrate that. That's a slap in the face. But the story continues on. And at this point, I just wanted to bring up some points about this story so far in a few articles written by a few people that helped me create this episode today. And so just kind of things to think about, I guess. And they just say it in a way that I couldn't say. It's just so much better. So I'll be sharing their words. And I will also put these articles in the show notes of this episode. So if you did want to have a read of those episodes, then you are free to do that. They will be there. If I don't put them on, send me a message because I do forget these things. We'll start off with an article by Olivia McGee called The Life and Legacy of David Oluwole, Why Britain Must Remember Him. And she, I quote, she says, race, class, mental illness and homelessness all intersect in Oluwole's tragedy. All our facets are intertwined and reinforce each other, leading to a complex spiderweb of systemic oppression and injustice. And, you know, the point raised here is the failings of several systems in his life. Healthcare, mental health provisions, obviously the police said they went beyond failing. And then the justice system, you know, that systemic oppression of this man in three different aspects. And also then these facets of his identity that intersect, race, class, mental illness and homelessness, which I mentioned before, which I took from Olivia's article, I will say. You know, it is a tragedy what happened to him. But hopefully, and what his story in one way should do is prompt us to think about, you know, the intersections of his identity that impacted his experience in this country and the systemic failings on so many levels. And oftentimes I think that is the experience of black people in this country. It's a systemic failings on more than one level. And that's why it's really difficult to ever pinpoint, you know, one thing. People have said like, oh, what do black people really want? Like, you know, what were the protests for? You know, what is it that black people wanted? And it is such a ridiculous question because systemic oppression goes across so many different systems and institutions. And this case shows it very clearly. It's not just one thing. You know, racial injustice has several ugly heads and it rears them in very different ways. But it comes from the same root. And the second quote is from another Olivia Wyatt. And this is in the History Matters Journal, which is available for free online. It's a great journal. If you want to read more about black history across, I say black in the most broadest sense, but in relation to Britain, it is definitely the place to go. The articles there are fantastic by a range of contributors that, you know, are academics, PhD students, master's students, and just people that have an interest in history. It's very, very good. And you can read about so many different topics, but there was an article by Olivia Wyatt called The Art of Narration, Memory, Voices and Archival Deadening in the Reconstruction of Black British History. And this was in the 2021 issue. And the point she makes here, and she says, I'm still saddened by the prospect that Oluwole's perspective appears to be lost forever, like the enslaved voices who were silenced by their master's control of their archival portrayal. It seems as though Oluwole is destined to die again and again, as archivists and researchers continuously revise the ways in which they present his story for him. I believe that this is the deadening that Perry, and by Perry she means Kenneth Salmon Perry, referred to in her work, the metaphorical death that many black British archival subjects undergo as they are silenced, dehumanised and invisibilised by the ways in which people and sources portray them. And I thought this was an interesting point because, you know, it thinks about it. We will never have his perspective, David Oluwale's. It's lost forever in many ways. And that is often the story and the narrative for so many. And by so many, I really do mean millions, because millions of voices were lost in the transatlantic slave trade. But even in more modern Britain, so many voices we will never hear, so many perspectives, because those lives were taken due to racism. Whether, you know, you think of black people killed by the police, killed by racist groups of people, unable to tell their story themselves, they become archival subjects. And it's something I've thought about before. There's so many names of so many black people across the world that we know of that become just archival subjects, because they are killed, silenced, dehumanized, whether they're lynched in America, killed by the police or so-called neighborhood watch groups. You know, it's just the same story. And for the most part, not to erase the stories of black women, but it's black men. I'm sure you can name at least five black men whose side of the story we never got to hear, because they were taken, they were murdered, they were killed, they were dehumanised, they were brutalised. And this is just another one of those stories. Not just, actually, because his life had value and his life was worth something because he's a human being. But we won't ever know that, know his perspective. And I just thought that was a really, I don't use the word amazing, but a really great point raised in that article. Now, I mentioned this story gets worse, and you might be thinking, how can this story possibly get worse? We're going to fast forward in to now, today, the present, because there is a David Oluwale Memorial Association, DOMA, and they campaigned for years to make sure there was a plaque nearby the bridge that David Oluwale was last seen alive. A blue plaque that would honour his life and honour his memory, and kind of remind Leeds, shall we say, of what had happened to this man. Now, this went up finally. Money was raised, you know, the plaque was created. It's a long process, you know, to put things in public view, to have things memorialised in the public presence. And when it was obviously, you know, given the all clear, money was sorted, it was on Monday, and I'm recording probably about 6 days after the plaque was put up. Within hours, and I'm not joking, hours, it was stolen. It was vandalised, it was stolen. It was taken down. Hours. This man did nothing to no one. You know, why is a blue plaque honouring his life so offensive to someone that they feel they should rip it down from its plinth? And the story gets worse, because the David Oluwale Memorial Association and other people in the city of Leeds, you know, did their best. They rallied round to create a temporary plaque. You know, they said, you know, we've put this plaque up, let's have a temporary one while a new one is created, or they can find out, you know, who vandalised it in the first place and took it down. So a new one went up. It was kind of like a laminated version of one. And it was obviously just to be temporary, because they'd spent years tirelessly campaigning for this man's, like, life to be remembered in the city. And you guessed it correctly, it was taken down again. So the laminated tribute went up on Wednesday. The original went up on Monday. Hours later, it was taken down. The other one went up on Wednesday. And again, it was vandalised. This was a plaque to commemorate a black man who was hounded, violated, dehumanised by the police, vandalised. Like, if, I don't know, if that doesn't say something about this place, then I don't know what will. It's been reported that West Yorkshire Police are treating both as incidents of hate crime, as they should. I hope they find whoever did this. It just, you know, it doesn't make sense. But racism in some ways doesn't make sense. In some ways it does. It's all about power, influence. Power and influence equals money a lot of the time. But it doesn't make sense because his man died, you know, and it's simply a plaque to honour his life. And I think I'll leave this episode with a quote from the third article that I read about this incident, which was written, you know, I think within the week, by Perry Blankston for Tribune magazine. And he said, though trying to repeatedly tear down his memorials, the perpetrators have sought to consign Oluwole to ignominy and death. And yet, David Oluwole lives. He lives on through every black person brutalised by the police, through those suffering at the hands of carceral boarders, through those stigmatised for mental illness, and the incalculable number of unhoused people sleeping rough on our streets. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. I hope you have a wonderful week. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the History Hotline. If you've enjoyed this episode, please tell a friend to tell a friend. To continue the conversation about black history, head over to our social media platforms at the History Hotline on Instagram and at the History HL on Twitter.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Turn your tax refund into a new landscape with Menards. Make this the year you check that project off the list. Create stunning patios and build strong retaining walls with our huge in-stock selection of beautiful concrete blocks ready to take home today. Plus, easily build and design your own raised garden beds with our garden block. On sale now. Check out our weekly flyer and start saving on landscape blocks now at Menards.
Save.